This is World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM, and this is the program What's New on Campus. And today we have very special guests, Dr. John Eichard and Dr. Lonnie Gamble. Welcome, Professor Eichard and Professor Gamble.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you, Stan. Thank you for all the great work you do here at KHOE and for bringing a voice out, from the commercial media that you don't get to hear this kind of thing. So I really appreciate what you do.
Well, I tell you, this conversations like we're going to have right now is next to my heart, because this not only affects ourselves and the community we live in, but the whole world. And you guys are doing a great job, which we're going to be discussing here in a moment. So thank you for coming. Dr. Eichard teaches at the University of Missouri and has an extensive background in agriculture and economics, and is the author of books on sustainable economics and agriculture, including Crisis of Opportunity, Sustainable Capitalism, and Sustainability in American Agriculture. Dr. Eichard is a guest here at MUM, teaching the course Economics and Sustainability, is that right? Along with Professor Gamble. Everyone in our community knows Professor Lonnie Gamble. He has credentials a yard long. He is an electrical engineer, works in sustainable energy, is a sustainable farmer. I think you still do that. You dabble in it like a lot of us do. And he is also a great contributor to the sustainable living program here on campus at Maharshi University Management. In fact, he's one of the founding fathers, and he's doing a great job. Students really like him. Well, it's not hard to guess where this conversation is going.
All right.
Maybe we can start with you, John. John, you not only talk the talk, but you walk the walk. Are you still farming?
No, I grew up on a small dairy farm down in southwest Missouri. And at that time, there wasn't room for all of us to stay there. There were three boys and two girls in the family. So we decided the youngest son, who really wanted to farm more than the rest of us did, all of us probably stayed on the farm. So I left the farm. But my brother's still on that farm, and he was still milking cows. I think it was about 2 years ago Thanksgiving when he decided he'd been milking cows morning and night long enough, so he decided to do other things. But I've worked with farmers my whole career after leaving the farm. I got my education at the University of Missouri, and then went into work in various land-grant universities, North Carolina State, Oklahoma State, University of Georgia, University of Missouri. But I always had at least a half-time extension appointment, which meant extending the university out to the countryside. And so I've been working with farmers my whole life.
Very good. Well, you're the right man for the job here, I think. And Lonnie, how did you pick Professor Eichard for this class, and how are the students enjoying this course?
Well, we have a lot of practical hands-on coursework in the sustainable living department. Students really like that. But I felt that we had a lack in courses that addressed the fundamental theory and fundamental intellectual ideas behind a sustainable economy. What are those fundamental principles that we need to establish intellectually that would guide public policy for a sustainable economy? Because if you look at the extractive and exploitive economy that we have now has its economic theory that's well established and guides public policy. And I've felt for a long time, we have, always really concerned about what the individual can do. And individual actions are very important. Individual responsibility, there's lots of things people can do. But they're constrained by the overall society that we're in, by the overall economy, by those broader constraints of what's available in the marketplace and what's available to do for work and how people are compensated. So I was really excited when I read John's book, Sustainable Capitalism. I said, this should be the foundational theory for what we teach about economics in our department and at our university, the economics of sustainability, the economics of enlightenment, the economics of heaven on earth. And so I called John up or emailed him, I don't remember which. I had known him just a little bit from when he came up here and worked at the university, and I'd also been following his work and his very inspiring speeches and things that he's been giving. And to my great surprise, he agreed to try this. And maybe John, you can tell a little bit about what you're thinking is in coming here, and it's kind of an experiment, and you may want to try this at several other universities, I think.
Right. When Lonnie contacted me, I think it was by email, and asked me about coming up here for a month, I thought, well, that's a long time away from home, and I'm not sure that I want to do it. And then I've been retired now for almost 10 years. I'm not really at the university anymore, but I have professor emeritus status, which means I'm retired in good standing. So I wasn't really sure, you know, that I wanted to take this on. And then I got to thinking about it, and it came to me that this might be kind of one of the next things that I need to do in my career, is try to focus on the people that are in college today and the young people, and try to inspire them to change the world, because we're at a point in time, which I call one of those great transitions, where we're moving out of the industrial era. In my opinion, industrial era is coming to a close. It's no longer sustainable, and we're moving forward to something that's fundamentally different. And the questions of sustainability are driving that great transition, because as we realize that what we're doing now is not sustainable, then we've got to do something else. But it's really going to be up to the young people to help create this new vision. You know, it takes a while to get through these transitions, and some of us that are as old as I am probably are not going to be here when the time comes when we realize exactly what the next era after industrialization is going to be. And so I thought, well, maybe I ought to do whatever I can to help inspire and inform and educate the younger generation that's going to have to create this new world.
Well, that certainly is something to think about, and very timely, especially during this financial situation the whole country is finding themselves in. And along that line, Dr. Eichert, right around the turn of the 20th century, what was the population of the farmers in this country? Is 70% or
60%? It was somewhere around 40%.
40%?
At the turn of the 20th century.
And now
it's 1800s.
And now it's about...
It's really about 1%, about 2% of the people classified as farmers, but about half of the farmers that are out there today have something other than farming as their principal occupation.
Uh-huh.
Not only are they part-time, but they're really, they do something else, essentially full-time, and farm on the side.
Now, I noticed I read a few things that you had written and heard you speak before, and your interests lie far to the far reaches of just farming. I mean, also the social economic condition of the country as far as farmers go in farming. And what do you think is the moral attitude and the moral fiber of people in this country making that transition from farming, being close to the land, having your hands in the dirt, being close to nature? Suddenly, they're sales clerks, or truck drivers, they're computer operators. I mean, you've been around for a while. Maybe you can tell us. What kind of observations do you have about this?
Well, of the people that are still farming, you know, a lot of farmers have gone out of business in this country. We had about 6 million farmers in the 1930s, and we'd like to say we got 2 million that call themselves farmers, probably 1 million today. So a lot of them aren't out there that have gone out of business. Some of those that have survived have been those that this idea of farming as a business and a bottom line kind of business, which I used to teach in our earlier days before I made my transition to sustainability, it kind of fits their sort of paradigm. You know, I call it the industrial approach of standardize, specialize, and then you can consolidate control. And that's what we've seen in agriculture. We used to have diversified family farms that they'd have crops and livestock and, you know, chickens and hogs and cattle and corn and soybeans and hay and wheat and various other things that are in rotation. And then over the years, they specialized in fewer and fewer things. First crop and then livestock and then one crop and one livestock, or two crops like in Iowa, corn, soybeans. So we specialized. And then once we did that, got into specialization, we had to kind of control the operations and standardize. That's what pesticides and fertilizers are about, to try to make the crop and livestock perform in a certain way, as I say, kind of like biological assembly lines. The farm's a factory without wheels and biological assembly lines. And whereas this fit the mindset of some of the farmers that went through that transition, because, you know, it was this sort of simplified way of dealing with things, I run across a lot of farmers that feel like that they're forced to do things to be competitive that they simply don't want to do. They're forced to do things in terms of the way they treat the land, the way they treat their neighbors, or the lack of respect for their neighbors and contribution to the community. And they're very uncomfortable about this. but they don't see any alternative to it, because this industrial system, specialization, standardization, consolidation, is a very efficient way of extracting productivity from the land and from people. And it's a very efficient way in terms of economics of reducing the cost of production. And so if you're trying to compete with somebody who's extracting and exploiting this process, you have a difficult time taking care of the land and caring about your neighbors and caring about the ethics and moralities there. You ask about the ethical principles of farming. One of the deepest part of the agriculture and farm ethic was to leave the land for the next generation as good or better than you found it. And I think a lot of farmers are today realizing that they're violating that ethic and they really don't feel good about it. So I think a lot of the farmers that are still out there today really feel uncomfortable with industrial agriculture and would be open to an alternative way of farming, such as we're talking about with sustainability, where you return to the diversity and the individuality and you look at the farm as a whole living organism. But they don't know how to make the transition. They don't know how to break away from the competition of this global economy and make that transition over to something that's sustainable, that would have to be a more human scale kind of agricultural operation, a more localized economy, and more personal kinds of relationships and a greater sense of ethics.
So it sort of comes down to competition and teamwork. I mean, it used to be that farmers helped each other out.
Right.
The Amish still do that today. Yeah. They help each other out. You don't see that too much today.
Right. Part of that industrial paradigm that allowed for the mechanization, it sort of allowed farmers a greater degree of independence, and that's one reason they adopted it. You know, we talk about the threshing circles, and where I was, we filled silos. It was a dairy area, so we'd fill silos. Back in the early times, I can remember when they still cut the corn with what they call corn knives. It's like machetes, and they'd come out and put it on the wagons, and we had horses, and they'd take it in and had a chopper and blower up at the silo. And the silo crews would be like 40 people that would go from farm to farm because it was so labor intensive. Well, you know, that was a good way to build community. And they got together and they'd eat together and travel from farm to farm together and so on. But at the same time, it was very confining, because to get your silo filled, then you had to work on all of these other farms during this period of time. And so there was the idea with the new equipment, where there's the threshing machines went to the combines, you know, the big threshers, the big people, a lot of group of people had to get together to handle that. But when they went to the combines, it gave the farmer then the independence and the freedom, you know, to combine the crop when it was right for that particular farm, and to chop the silage and put it in the silo, you know, much more quickly and do it on their own. So it seemed very seductive then to have this freedom to do things when you wanted to and to be on your own. And so I think the farmers, it's kind of like capitalism as a total, you know, pursuing my individual self-interest, you know, it seemed to be a good thing. But I don't think they realized what they were going to lose in the process. And a lot of them are looking back now and saying, we don't have the close-knit farm communities that we used to have. Mm-hmm. We don't have the groups of people that work together and get together and socialize together. And now they see their communities totally transformed. It's not just the farmers and it's not the people that grew up there, because the rural areas are kind of becoming the areas where people that can't afford to buy a piece of property or rent a piece of property in the city move out and put in a mobile home or something. You know, I'm not blaming people trying to find a place to live, but it changes the whole character of the rural community. There's no sense of connectedness. So they made decisions that kind of seemed to make sense at the time, which I think is what we all do. But I think there's a realization now that they gave up much more than they ever thought that they would lose whenever they made that decision for economics and for convenience.
There seems to be a continuing theme in this, because even today, it used to be that if you had a Ford tractor that weighed 900 pounds or 1,000 pounds, man, you were just, you know, you were living. Now, you get bigger tractors and bigger tractors, you compact the soil, you have all kinds of problems like that. And like you said, they don't go around in teams to fill people's silos anymore. They get a big machine to do it.
Right.
And this, do you see this changing?
Yes, I think we're going to recognize sooner or later that this kind of agriculture that we created simply is not sustainable over the long run. Probably a lot of the things we've been talking about in the past is the fact that we have the, you know, erosion of the soil and depletion of the natural productivity of the soil. When we go to the commercial fertilizers, you know, particularly the nitrogen fertilizers come in, then you can get away from the crop rotations that built the organic matter and the life and the health of the soil. In fact, you destroy a lot of life and health in the soil. So we're mining basically organic matter in the soil, and what we aren't mining, we're letting, erode off into the stream. So we're losing that. And we substituted for that, we've substituted basically fossil energy based inputs. Nitrogen fertilizers, a high fossil energy base made out of natural gas that's used for kind of the feedstock as well as the heat and the pressure to create the product. So we've ended up with an agriculture that was once kind of a solar energy collecting agriculture. There was very little other than human energy or animal energy that went into agriculture, to one that's heavily dependent upon fossil energy. And, for example, there's been estimates made. David Pimentel out at Cornell University estimates that it takes about 10 calories of fossil energy for every 1 calorie of food energy that's produced. Now, a lot of that's in the distribution system, but even at the farm level, it takes about 3 calories of fossil energy. So if you look to the future out here, and I think there's a kind of a growing consensus that we're either very near or at a peak in global oil production. And from here on out, we're not necessarily running out, but it's going to be more expensive and there's going to be less of it. And all of the substitutes for the oil in terms of fossil energy are either going to be more expensive or they're going to, to extract, or they're going to be more expensive to use because they're polluting, such as coal. So we're going to have to spend a lot if we're going to burn coal to keep it clean. So as we look to the future, we're running out of cheap fossil energy. And that's what supports our agriculture. And I contend that we've got maybe 40 or 50 years left to recreate agriculture, to return it to an agriculture that basically runs on solar energy. And that will mean that we'll have to go back to more intensive farming operations that build the land, the diversified crop and livestock systems integrated together, and more management intensive in the sense that our farmers, in order to be productive in these organic sustainable systems, can produce more per acre, actually, than the industrial operations can, but they can't farm as many acres as you can with the big machines. So it's going to be smaller farms, it's going to be more farmers, is what's going to have to drive it in as we go into the future. And it's not going to be a choice, it's going to be a necessity. As we run out of the cheap fossil energy, we're going to have to find somewhere else to feed ourselves. See, we're biological beings. We can't eat the electricity that comes out of a windmill or a hydroelectric dam or a photovoltaic cell or whatever. We may use those sources of energies to do a lot of things, but in order to fuel the human being, produce food, we're going to have a biological agriculture because we're biological beings, and that will cause a fundamental transformation in the way we farm. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's already happening with the growth in natural and organic foods and the farmers markets and the CSAs and increased direct marketing, the whole local food movement. That's the beginning of a great transition within agriculture out of the industrial era and into something fundamentally different.
Well, this sounds like good news. Well, you're an electrical engineer. What part do you think that the science of engineering, electrical engineering, is going to play in farming coming up?
Well, John's been making these points about, talking a lot about energy and the flow of energy in agricultural systems. And energy has a much more fundamental place, and maybe I'll ask you to talk about John, just a second. When you think about it, if you have a non-living system, typically it gets less complex and more dispersed over time. If you put air, if you have air in the tire in your car, if the air leaks out, it takes energy to put that air back in. It never goes back in by itself. So things tend to disperse. And so in order to create orderliness and complexity in any system on Earth, it takes energy to bring that back in. It's the second law of thermodynamics. And so, John, would you like to talk a little bit more about how you've made that central in your discussion about economics in sustainable capitalism and in discussion?
Right.
It's kind of a central principle in moving to this new world, this new economy, right, and this new farming system. They're all one and the same, really, aren't they?
Right. Because at the very foundation of sustainability is about energy, because everything that's of any use to us, our houses, our clothes, our cars, take energy to make and energy to use. And even, the human thinking, working, innovating, all of that requires energy. I read an estimate one time that about 20% of the energy we use in our bodies is used in the brain. And so that requires energy. In addition to that, you know, we aren't born as people that are productive, that can think and create. We're born as helpless little babies that have to be nurtured and cared for and educated and socialized, civilized. All that requires energy, and that comes from society. So everything that's any use to us comes from energy. Now, the first law of thermodynamics is that you can use energy over and over again, and it's never energy's never created or destroyed. So you can use it over and over again. You don't destroy it. But the second law says every time you use it, some of the usefulness is lost. And that's because, as Lonnie says, whenever you use energy, you always go change the form from a more concentrated, organized form to a more dispersed, disorganized form, like when you let the air out of that tire. Now, if you want to reconcentrate and reorganize that energy, then it takes energy to do it. And if you don't reconcentrate it and restore it, then it's more dispersed and disorganized, and so it won't do as much work as it would before. So no matter how efficiently we get in terms of recycling, reusing, reducing our use of energy, we're slowly using up the usefulness of energy that's out there. And that's as true as in agriculture or industry, anywhere in society, but certainly within agriculture, as we use the resources over and over again, as we become dependent upon fossil energy, we're slowly using up that energy. And the only real source of sustainability is the solar energy. That's a new inflow of energy every day, and that's the only source that we know of that we are capable of using to offset the loss of usefulness of the energy that's inevitably associated with that second law of thermodynamics, which is called entropy. And another thing that people fail to realize, but it's tied in with all of this, everything of any economic value, and economics has become kind of the driver of our society, not only the economy, but the whole guiding principles of our society. Everything of any economic value either comes from nature or it comes from society, because it has to be based on that energy that comes from nature or comes from society. So in our industrial system, whether it's industrial agriculture or manufacturing or whatever it is, it's very efficient in extracting and using that energy from nature and society, but there's no economics in incentive to regenerate and renew the energy for the benefit of anybody other than the decision maker. So we're slowly using it up. Sustainability says that we must meet the needs of the present without diminishing opportunities for the future. It's basically a moral and ethical commitment to the future of humanity, because there's no sense in which we have any responsibility for those of future generations other than an ethical or moral sense. There's no economic value there, because after we're dead, there's no way of realizing economic value. Economic value is inherently individualistic. There's no social value there, because we won't know anybody in those future generations. So the only sense in which we feel a responsibility for them is through that ethical sense of responsibility to the future. And if we fulfill that responsibility, then we have to regenerate and renew the energy from nature and society that we're using up to do things useful and to do things that have economic value. Sustainable economy must be regenerative and self-renewing. An industrial economy has been inherently extractive and exploiting. We can't continue to extract and exploit. We have to transfer to something that regenerates and renews.
And that extractive, exploitive economy is kind of a linear system, and it's really designed at its heart to take this higher order energy and stuff and turn it into lower order entropy without giving back, and we've been able to do that for a while because there was a lot more stuff than people.
Right.
And now we got a lot more people than stuff, as you pointed out, John, it's not a question of we're going to choose one of these things or the other. We're going to come to that point right. One day where the energy that we take, that we have available to give back and to regenerate and renew is solar energy.
Right.
And that's kind of the future when you look from farming or you look from economics. We have that, we have to convert to that basis.
Right. And you indicated, that I was an economist and Lonnie's an electrical engineer. But just like when we move into the future where we're talking about farmers not being, a cattle feeder or being a corn and soybean farmer, but having to be more diversified, the scientists of the future, if we're going to deal with sustainability, are going to have to be more diversified as well, even within themselves. I concluded early on as an economist that if I was going to deal with sustainability, even though I wasn't going to get a PhD in biology or in physics or or in sociology or psychology or any of these areas out here, that I had to be much broader than just an economist, because sustainability requires taking care of the earth. That's a ecological, a biological concept, and requires taking care of society. That's a sociological, or psychological sort of concept, and there's a whole range of concepts. So as scientists, we may be, you know, I'm a better economist today than I've ever been in my life. I know more of what's important about economics than I've ever known before, but I've had to expand out and try to understand the broadness of the disciplines that are associated with sustainability. And Lonnie's doing the same thing. In fact, the only condition under which I agreed to come up here and teach this course, I said, I don't want to do this indefinitely. I want to co-teach it with you. One reason is because I want to integrate people within the local community and contact the students with reality. But the other is I want you to teach this course in the future. And if we teach it together one time, then hopefully that'll help you prepare to teach it in the future. So I'm really as interested in preparing teachers for the future of sustainability as preparing students.
Well, I think this is a perfect matchup. But Lonnie, maybe you can say a little bit about the future of science. Is science up to this task? Are we going to have the scientific ability to turn all of our energy needs into solar and wind and all that?
Well, we're in the midst of a huge revolution. What we're talking about, the sustainability revolution that John's talking about, is really, you know, when you think about economics and you think about farming and you think about all these different areas, really what we're thinking about in sustainability is reimagining, reinventing everything that humans do. And everything that humans do, we mean everything that humans do, banking and money systems, urban design, farming, everything. And so including science. And so, we had this big transition, you know, maybe 400, 500 years ago, where we went from sort of the Middle Ages, we went to this age of reason, this age of enlightenment we went through in that time, with Descartes and Bacon and all those folks. And so we're in the midst of rethinking, and we turned towards a mechanistic view of the universe. We turned towards looking at the universe as a big machine where we could, you know, which was kind of set in place by its creator, and then the creator stepped back, and we could take it apart, and we could look at all the pieces just like you would a machine. And now what we're starting with the more modern understandings of physics, quantum physics and other things, we understand that the world is much more complex and world is much more like a living organism than it is like a machine. And so that's the science of the future, I think, is to integrate this new paradigm, completely different worldview, really, not reconcilable with the old, not just an extension of the old worldview, but a completely different worldview. And that's what we're trying to impart. You know, that's kind of what John's imparting, you know, to me, and I'm learning by my, I feel super fortunate to be able to work with John. I feel like I'm here with Thomas Jefferson at the beginning of the revolution. And John talks a lot about revolution. I'd like to hear him talk a little bit about that, as we go on. But, so really we're rethinking science. We're rethinking science in silos. We're rethinking what those principles are. And really we go back to the principles of biology. So I'm an engineer. I have to learn about biology. Really right now I'm completely taken with this area of economics and learning with John about how that works, because I feel like we have to go back and we have to take a look at those fundamental sort of common sense principles. Maybe John, you can talk a little bit about common sense, that underlie every field. These principles that cannot be proven or disproven, but they're what generates everything that comes out of that particular discipline, and that's the kind of work we're trying to do, so that then we can create a context where people can lead their lives, where the natural expression and flow of their life generates this sustainable economy. So, John, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, one thing, in following up on your science, and then we'll go to the common sense. If we just think back over the last 400 years, the 200 years in particular of the industrial era, the tremendous advances from science that have come during that time have been basically in the physical science, what we call those sciences that fit the mechanistic model best. It's been physics and chemistry and engineering and architecture and things like that, where basically the non-living world. Now, we've taken those same principles, those mechanistic principles, and we've applied them in the living world to plants and animals, and they they sort of work on plants and animals, but you end up with a lot of unintended consequences because the organism responds to whatever you've done to it. You know, like genetic manipulation and things like that, we'll see the consequences of that in the future as these organisms respond. But then when we've applied those same sciences as we have in economics and psychology and sociology and places like that, it really has hardly worked at all. I say as an economist, most of the useful things economists have done, they came to the conclusion intuitively and then said, how can I explain this in a mechanistic way that will give it some credibility? But the problems that we're confronted with today are not necessarily the engineering and mechanical and chemical and those problems. We've solved a lot of those. The problems we're facing today are the ecological problems that are associated with living systems. They have non-living parts, but they're living systems. And the social problems within societies and the ethical problems and the current scientific method just simply is incapable of dealing with these things because they're too complex and they're too interrelated, and it's virtually impossible to isolate cause and effect because everything has a cause and effect has another cause and another effect and another cause and another effect that comes back to the beginning. And so it simply doesn't fit. And as Lonnie was saying about common sense, when we go through these points in time where what we're doing isn't working and it's incapable of kind of solving the problems that are confronting us today, and fundamental change is necessary, but we don't know yet what this new science will look like, what this new paradigm of economic development will look like, what this, you know, what will evolve out of this, then the only thing you can do during these times is the old isn't working, the new isn't here, is to return to those core values, those core things that we know are right and true. And I say it's our common sense because if you look within all of us, no matter what our race or religion or nationality or age or education, there's a certain set of values that we share in common. And let me give you some example. There's an organization called the Institute for Global Ethics, and they've gone all around the world and they've interviewed people and done focus groups and all different nationality and ages and incomes and so on. And they say, sure, we have different values because they arise out of those different cultures, but we share a set of core values. And the five they came up with that consistently showed up was honesty, fairness, responsibility, respect, and compassion. And they said that these values are the most highly held in virtually all generations, I mean, among all nations and all people. I would say those are common sense principles of how we have to relate to each other as human beings if we want to have positive relationships. That's the reason they're held in such high esteem. Now, nobody can prove that. You know, we didn't derive that from some scientific principle or some scientific logic. It's the common sense within us all that if we want to have good relationships, we've got to be fair and honest and responsible and respectful, compassionate. You know, who's going to stand up and argue that you can be unfair, dishonest, disrespectful, uncaring?
I think a few bankers on Wall Street might have an issue with that.
Well, they may feel like they can get along with violating, but they know in their heart they're violating. Well, there's principles like that are within in natural ecosystems, fundamental principles of healthy ecosystems like holism, interconnected, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Diversity. Healthy ecosystems are always diverse. You can't be the same. In fact, you could describe entropy as the lack of diversity, differentiation. It's a system where all of the life and all of the energy has been extracted from.
Which is so where we're headed.
Yeah, which is the idea. But diversity is essential. And then mutuality or interdependent relationships among those diverse elements within the whole. Just fundamental common sense principles that if you're going to have a healthy living system, it has to have it. And there are certain kind of common sense principles in economics. You know, economic principles, the most fundamental, is not something made up by a bunch of economists. The economy deals with how we pursue our individual self-interest. It doesn't deal with the social interest of honesty and respect and compassion, those sort of things, or the ecological, but it deals with our individual self-interest. And economic value is determined by scarcity because we as individuals value things most that we have the greatest need for that we don't have. If we get more and more of something beyond some point, it's not scarce and we don't want anymore. We don't need anymore as an individual within a time frame. It's inherent within us. That's just the way we are as a being. we also an economic principle of efficiency. We want to get as much as we can out of whatever we have to use. We want to use our resources, our talents, our ability to get as much satisfaction or whatever we're looking for. And the other is sovereignty. We want to be free to make choices, decide for ourselves what we want to do. Okay, these are core principles. You can't prove those, but they're just common sense. And I like to say that if you go back, every scientific discipline, even the hardest sciences, are based on a set of initial axioms or assumptions that you don't prove, as Nani said before. The example I like to take is in mathematics. We think of mathematics as being so rigorous. But if you go back to algebra, there's about six principles that you start from that all other proofs are based on. You know, one of those is A times B equals B times A. You can't prove that. You say it just makes sense, right? So 3 times 4 is equal to 4 times 3. Well, you take six things like that, and all of the rigorous mathematic proofs are just based on that common sense. But if you apply that in a different situation, and you say, okay, we're going to apply that in sociology, relations among people, well, it makes a difference who's first and who's second. You know, A times B is not equal to B times A, because it says in one case A comes first, and the other case A comes second. And it makes a difference where you rank in terms of social equity and social issues. See what I'm getting at? So we go through these great transitions, then we've got to return to our common sense and say, okay, what are we doing today that simply doesn't make sense, and quit doing it, and then test the new things we want to do and say, does this make sense? And if it does, then we begin to develop the new way of thinking about things.
I think one of our readings we had the... this quote from Edwin Land, which was, oftentimes, innovation is, or new knowledge just comes about from the sudden cessation of stupidity.
Kind of like a return to common sense.
Well, this idea about getting rid of what doesn't work, and that sort of follows with the no-till farming kind of came about in that way, didn't it? Suddenly the soil was disappearing, and they decided, right. Well, let's do something different.
Right. No-till farming was really started, the first I heard of it was back in, mid to late 70s. And when I first heard about it, it was the first energy crisis, or the energy crisis of the 1970s, because you see, you cut down a lot on using gasoline, you go across in no-till farming. And then when they came out later on in the 90s, then you had the government come out with the conservation programs as an important part of the farm bill, and then your government payments then were based on whether or not you had conservation compliance. In other words, to get the commodity payments, you had to comply with conservation regulations. And that made no-till look very, very attractive at that point, because in order to get your government payments, then you could go out here and no-till. But the thing that really brought no-till, and we tend to think of that as being a great conservation tool, and it is a good conservation tool, but the thing that brought it around was basically the economics of it. And the fact was that it wasn't so much more profitable per acre, but with fewer pastures across the field, you know, it was less energy and less erosion. But the biggest thing was fewer pastures meant the farmers could farm more acres. So we tend to look at no-till as kind of a sustainable technology, and it is from the conservation standpoint. But when you look at the standpoint of the social standpoint and the ability of people to make a good living on the land, it really moved us toward fewer farmers
bigger farms, fewer farmers.
And so, and also at the same time, it was heavily reliant on pesticides to kill off the crops since you weren't tilling. So that's a good example of when you're looking at sustainability, you can't just look at one dimension and say, well, it's more ecologically sound, or it's more socially responsible, or more socially supportive, or more economically viable. You've got to balance all three of those in terms of looking at the long run sustainability of it. Just because it uses less fuel and it's more conserving doesn't mean that it's going to sustain agriculture over the long haul.
It might be a little less bad, but not in the right direction. And we want to go beyond being less bad to do something that's positively good.
Right.
John, you've talked a little bit about economics being about individual self-interest, about, you know, maximizing sort of the individual good and the collective individual good. And, but you expand economics. Originally was a science that was about human welfare and maximizing human welfare in general. And so it looked at sort of the whole person.
Right.
And then over time that holistic focus narrowed down to specifically an economic focus, to the point where today we relate human welfare with economic wealth, with economic wealth. There's been a lot of studies actually now that show that our increasing influence on wealth through our economic system is actually making us less happy.
Right. And yes, there's scientists that have come along, and I say it's kind of our, again, our common sense. And when I wrote the book, I really relied pretty heavily on that, saying, okay, it's our common sense that just our individual well-being is important. You know, we're material beings. We need enough to eat and clothing and shelter and something over a roof over our head and things like that. So that's important. But I said our common sense tells us that we need positive relationships with other people. You know, we're created as social beings. You know, we need to relate. We need to love and to be loved. We need friends. We need family. We need community. It's just the way we're created. And we also need some sense of purpose and meaning in life in order for life to be worth living. And if we simply pursue our individual material interest at the cost of our social relationships or violates our value or moral ethical values, and we lose that sense of purpose and that sense of connectedness, and we're not as well off. Now, since then, I've discovered the science, and I think a lot of the science has been developed in the last 10 years that validates that from the standpoint of asking people, you know, in different countries and different income levels and things, how happy they are, and observing different measurements of satisfaction and happiness. And the study that probably has getting the most attention was a review study of something like 150 other studies that had been done on happiness, and they drew the conclusion from that study that material well-being and wealth is important, but only in the developed nations, only up to about $10,000 per person. And beyond $10,000 per person, whether you're happy or not, or doesn't have very much of anything to do with wealth. It has more to do with the quality of relationships. Do you have close friends, or do you have family? Do you have a sense of being treated with equity and justice within the society or culture in which you live? And then beyond that is whether or not people have a sense of purpose in life, a sense of to give life meaning. Is there a sense that you're making a contribution that's worthwhile? And if you're lacking in terms of that sense of purpose and meaning or in relationships, it doesn't matter how wealthy you are, you're probably going to end up being unhappy. Now, it doesn't say that wealthy people can't be happy if they have positive relationships and a good sense of purpose and meaning. It just says that beyond some very modest point, there's really no relationship or very little relationship between wealth and happiness. But yet we have a society that's driven by this assumption that if we just had more stuff, then we'd be happier. The whole economy that we have today, the industrial economy, is geared up to give us more and more cheap stuff. And I ask students oftentimes, I should ask this class, I haven't asked them before, but I ask young people when I go around and have guest lectures at college, I say, if you could imagine a world 50 years from now that was fundamentally better, what would be the dominant characteristic of that world? A rhetorical question. More cheap stuff? And I think the obvious answer is no. That twice as much cheap stuff, which is what we'd have in 50 years, is not what this country or not what they really need. They need a better sense of relationships, a world in which people can get along together, where there's fewer conflicts, fewer lawsuits, less crime, fewer wars, and a world in which people have a more of a deep sense of purpose and meaning, that they feel right and good about the way they're living their lives and their work and what they're doing. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about moving toward sustainability. When we talked about moving toward a world in which we have social responsibility in the way we go about doing our work, and when there's ecological integrity about what we're doing, taking care of nature, taking care of each other, and economic viability, taking care of ourselves individually, the balance and harmony among those three. While we tend to look at sustainability as a sacrifice today, it's not. It's moving toward a fundamentally better way of life that will make us happier. Not less happy, not constrained, not a sacrifice. I tell people, you know, if you really listen to your common sense, if you look in your heart that you know that it's not a sacrifice to care for other people because it makes our lives better when we do so than when we don't. And it's not a sacrifice to be a steward of nature and to be concerned about the future of humanity because it makes our life better when we do those things. It gives purpose and meaning to our life. So I think the sustainability movement will really catch on when people realize that yes, we're talking about what we're doing now is not sustainable and we have to change, but we're talking about moving to something that's fundamentally better than what we have today.
Well, Professor John Eichert and Professor Lonnie Gamble, this is such a conversation go on forever, but I just want to ask you, you're both educators, and it used to be, and when I was a kid, we had the 4-H Club, and we had the Future Farmers of America. You think there's going to be anything like this for sustainable living? I mean, it seems like these clubs and these organizations still teach the same things that we're trying to change.
Well, you know, I think that's a really good point. And I haven't worked so much on youth education. I work mainly on college age and above. And and there's a real hunger for, you know, finding the details of what John's talking about. You know, it's interesting in our class, you know, oftentimes, you know, they're, okay, so exactly how do we do this? What's the cookbook for where we go? What our students are starting to realize is, you know, when you talk about efficiency, and when you talk about substitution, talk about getting more efficient at doing the same old things, or you're talking about changing from, say, fossil fuels to renewable energy, we have cookbook ways to do that. But when we talk about rethinking everything that humans do, when we talk about redesigning the system, we don't have a cookbook for that. And John, this course really is bringing kids, our students, right to the cutting edge of where that is. And they are making up the answers. That's the great work of the next, the next 50 or 100 years. These kids and the students that follow them, they're going to be creating that. And so that's, you know, John has some ideas, and he's laying out these principles which can guide this. And you can think of this as sort of the basic constitution. The basic constitution of what sustainability is going to be about. But to get back to your question about education and these organizations, there's no reason in the future why they couldn't all be the leaders in this new way of thinking about humans living on the planet. There's no reason why they couldn't be. And I think it's up to these kids here to take over those organizations and change that mindset and change that thinking. John,
right. Well, I think we'll probably have to recreate the kind of clubs we have and the kind of social organizations we have. And that's returning kind of to the principles as opposed to just looking at the structure that's there in the past. I think the structure that was there in the past with the 4-H clubs and the Boys and Girls Clubs and things of that nature, I think that fit the times. Most of those social organizations, civic organizations, were formed during the first half of the last century. We read a book this time that pointed out that there's been very few of those social organizations formed in the last half of the 20th century. It's all in the first half. And they seem to fit that time. I think there will be new organizations, but I think the underlying concept was the connectedness. It was a way to develop social connectedness among young people and connect them with people that could provide them with information and guidance as they went ahead. I think we will reconnect, but I don't know whether it will be in clubs like we've had before that will meet in parents' homes or whatever. You know, people talk about the internet, and I think the internet will be a part of it because that lets people communicate, but it still doesn't connect them personally, face to face, where they can share feelings and share values in that way. I'm not smart enough, I say, to figure out what the future is going to be like, but I think if we can look at some of those principles that we've got to get reconnected with each other socially, and there's got to be a reconnection with those core ethical and moral values that will guide us into the future. And I'm not talking about any particular religion here when I talk about ethical and moral values. You call it as much philosophy as anything else. It's the questions of what's fundamentally right and wrong about how we relate to each other and how we relate to the earth. And we've got to reexamine those, and even scientists have got to be willing to ask those questions and let that guide their scientific inquiry and the things they study and don't study.
You know, I think that ties in with the core mission of the university here, which is to allow people to, in a very easy and spontaneous and natural way, turn within and find that infinite source of satisfaction within, which you'll never find in material life. What our economy is doing is trying to convince us that level of satisfaction, that human desire for more and more, can be found in the outside world. And here at this university, we know that that's going to be a fruitless task in the long term, and that we can find that going within. So,
very good. I guess young young families like Lonnie's family here is going to have to determine the future of educating the younger people in the world. Maybe he'll start a club when your kid gets big enough. But I always found that fascinating because I actually enjoyed, I participated in some 4-H club activities and things, and I found it very nourishing. I thought it was a great thing. But I hate to even think what they're telling them or what they're talking about in this club these days.
Well, I'm not, you know, it's been a while since I've been directly involved in 4-H work. I was when I was still with the university to some extent. And I think once you get beyond what they're telling them about agriculture, then 4-H is still very much about building character and helping people develop social skills and leadership skills and things of that nature. I just don't think it's as important part of the rural community or communities in general as it was some years ago. I think the young people that participate in it probably get a great deal out of it still. There's just fewer that participate in it because I think it doesn't fit the way a lot of people want to relate these days. And I didn't mean to jump over the agricultural part real fast, but I think there's a real pressure within agricultural universities, and that's where the extension programs come that support 4-H and things like that to conform to that industrial model. I think the questions of sustainability are perceived to be, and they are, a real threat to the status quo in industrial agriculture today. So there's a very defensive attitude about raising any kind of issues like we're talking about here that we question the sustainability of that industrial agribusiness paradigm of agriculture. So a lot of our students, I can tell you firsthand in the big agricultural colleges, I call it more an indoctrination than an education when it comes to the future of agriculture. And I suspect that's true in youth organizations as well.
And John, isn't that's kind of a good news that there's that concern, because what were those three stages that we talked about of the acceptance of a new paradigm? What was it? You remember?
Well, when any big new idea comes along that you know that really is perceived to be, it could turn into a serious threat for those that are in existing positions of power, either economically, politically, or both. The first thing you want to do is ridicule it. You want to say, "Well, this is ridiculous. Why would anybody be so silly as to think of this idea?" When we first started talking about sustainable agriculture, low input agriculture, they said, "Oh, they want farmers to go back with farming with hoe handles and fish heads. You know, burying a fish head in each corn mound of corn that you hold up and things like that." We made all kinds of fun of organic farmers. I say they kind of labeled them, and I was at the meetings where they were talking about this. It's kind of the naked hippies running through the goods, woods, showing out a few seeds here and there and hoping they grow. So that's the first stage. You ridicule it and laugh at it and hope it'll go away. And then if it doesn't go away, if it persists, then the next thing you do is attack it and try to destroy it. You just, you know, actually mount vicious attacks that say this is subversive. It's going to starve everybody, like they're saying about organic, you know. They start off saying, I think it was Earl Butz that said, which half of the people do you want to starve? Mm-hmm. And then they've got people like from the Hudson Institute saying, you know, if we go to organic agriculture, we're going to have to plow up all of the forest and wildlife reserves, and there won't be any place for wildlife habitat and all this kind of stuff. Okay, then if it persists after that, then you try to co-opt it. You try to take it over and guide it in the direction that you want. And I think that's what we're seeing today with the big companies, you know, taking over the organic companies. And Walmart's got organic food and various other things. And Sysco want to put local food in the cafeterias, you know, the biggest food distributor in the country. They're saying if this local and organic is popular, then we'll take it over. But in order to make it work for them, they're not willing to change from this old industrial paradigm of specialization, standardization, consolidation of control. And so they simply try to work it into their system. And when you take something that may be sustainable in the sense that it's holistic, it's diverse, it's interdependent, you know, it's honest, it's fair, it's trustworthy, and those characteristics, those principles of sustainability, and you try to integrate it into that industrial system, you invariably will begin to violate the principles, and you will give up on the things that get in the way of profitability. So that's kind of the stage where we are today. And once we reject the false adoption of the new paradigm, then the true adoption of it takes place, and you have the transformation within society.
And then everybody just said, "Well, that's obvious."
Yeah. why did it take us so long to figure this out? Yeah, why would anybody do anything different?
Well, this has been most interesting, gentlemen. Lonnie, I wonder if you would mind describing to our listening audience the Sustainable Living Program here at Maharshi University of Management, and a degree program, and who can get into it, and how do they do it, and who do they contact?
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, Dan. You asked me about the Sustainable Living Program. We started as the biology department here at MUM, and a lot of the students and faculty there were interested in this area of sustainable living. Made a switch about 5 years ago, and we went from 6 students to now we have around 90 full-time students in that program. It's the largest undergraduate program at the university. I think something like 60 or 70% of the traffic that comes to the university, it comes looking for sustainable living information. So, we are struggling to keep up with that growth. And to me, it's the most terrifically exciting place I could possibly be on the planet right now, working with people like John Eichert and with this fantastic students that we have and all the creative projects that are going on. And the idea with our program is to give students the skills to design, build, and maintain sustainable communities. And what do we mean by design, build, and maintain sustainable communities? Like, John was talking about earlier, it's rethinking everything that humanity does. So it's renewable energy. It's local organic farming systems. It's building with local natural materials. It's urban design. It's banking and money systems. It's economics. It's all those things. And our goal there, sometimes people come and they think, oh, well, I'm going to become a solar equipment installer. I'm going to learn how to put wind turbines. Well, you can do that to some extent, but if you want to become a professional at that, there's places where you can do that easier and cheaper than you can in our program. Our program is to give you a broad understanding, because what's really needed a lot these days, we feel, is people who are systems thinkers, who are whole systems thinkers and designers. And so that's what we try to give you, is that holistic perspective. We have the ability to go deep in some areas with tracks, with a series of courses that have prerequisites in things like energy and agriculture. You can actually take a 6-month program and learn how to be a small farmer and learn how to grow crops and sell them at a farmer's market or operate a CSA. So, it's a terrifically exciting place to be this year. Every year, the kids who are going through the program kind of quicker and graduating earlier, that, hey, wait a minute, I should have slowed down a little bit. I could have been in John Eichert's class or one of these other fantastic people that were coming. So we're also working to develop a master's program. Looks like 2011 we'll be offering a master's program in sustainable living. And it's a brand new field. If you're looking at things like physics and chemistry and business administration, those are well-established disciplines that, thousands of institutions teach, and they have a well-developed, curriculum. We're really inventing that here. And so, it's terrifically exciting, and I so appreciate, and I learn so much every day, working with people like John Eichert and working with all of our students. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here at MUM.
Well, I tell you, from what I hear from the students, it's quite an enjoyable experience going through this program of yours, and it's very timely too. I guess a lot of universities are trying to set up these kind of things, but it's sort of unique here, especially because of our consciousness-based education.
Yeah, that's I think one of the things that's missing from most of the other curriculums is this kind of connection to ourselves and connection to that level of ourself at which everything else is connected. The way I like to think about it is when we meditate, we go inside and we have the direct experience of that level at which everything is connected. And then when we come out and learn in the field of sustainable living or practice in the field of sustainable living, it's the intellectual exploration and the practical application of that level at which everything is connected. So we have the experience through meditation, and then we have the intellectual exploration and practical understanding. I think that's why it's so powerful here.
Well, it's been wonderful, and Dr.
Thank you.
John Eichert, we're so lucky to have you here, and you're such a distinguished specialist in this field.
Well, Lonnie flatters me all the time. It's nice to be flattered. I just hope I don't start believing all of it.
Well, I'm a believer. But we're all waiting to hear your talk in Dalby Hall. This will be Wednesday, at 7:30 on the campus of Maharshi University of Management, and again on Thursday at the library in town at 7:30.
And it'll be two different presentations. I'll cover a few of the core points, but I wanted to make them different. When I'm talking on campus here, I'm going to be talking about basically the economics of sustainability. People keep asking me, what are we teaching in this course? And I'm going to hit some of the high points of that and kind of give the whole picture on that. When I go into town, then into the community, I'm going to focus more on agriculture and what I see as the future of agriculture and rural communities, or communities like Fairfield that are largely dependent upon rural areas.
We also, if you want to know more about the course, we put all of our courseware online for this course. We have a course wiki, which I don't have the address for, but if somebody wants to email me, LonnieGamble@yahoo.com, I'll give you that link. And it's got a lot of really fantastic talks by Dr. Eicher. John had he gives 40 or 50 he's in 40 or 50 invited talks every year, and a lot of those have been filmed, and some really fantastic. You want to get an up great date on what the course was going on with the course, we have a half an hour talk by John that kind of summarizes everything we're doing in the course. All of our readings are online, and I highly recommend John's book, Sustainable Capitalism. We're going to be showing a film that we're going to invite the public to. So John's talking Wednesday and Thursday night. Tuesday night, if you just can't get enough of this stuff, you can come to the west wing of the library, to the room 119, the sustainable living wing. We're going to be showing the film Fresh. And John, you want to say, do we have time to say a little bit about the film Fresh? Yeah. And then we'll...
The film Fresh is basically about the local food movement, but it talks a little bit about the problems of industrialization of agriculture. But what I like about it, it gives a better balance. It moves beyond and shows you some real farmers that are doing things differently, and how this movement is transforming the food system, going through, some reasonable scale retail operations and things where we're reaching more people. So it's a good balance between what's not sustainable and what we are looking to the future in terms of sustainability.
Good. Well, this has been a very enjoyable session. Thank you, gentlemen. And I guess we'll have to leave it at that. I hope we have a chance to talk again at some point, because this is just such marvelous things that we're talking about. And everyone is so interested in this now. It's such a hot topic for everybody. So thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And
thanks, Dan. Thanks for all the great work you do here at KHOE. It's fantastic.
Well, having people like you come in is a real easy for me. And this is Stan Stansbury, thanking you for joining us on the program What's New on Campus at KHUE 90.5 FM on your dial. Thank you for joining us.